Welcome back to Beyond the Signal, where we go deeper into the challenges, blind spots, and breakthroughs shaping cybersecurity for small and mid-sized businesses. Today's episode is called Fractional, Not Optional, Why VCSOs Are Now Critical Infrastructure, and for good reason. We're joined by David Minichiello, Chief Revenue Officer at SideChannel, to break down the role of the virtual CISO and why companies are waiting too long to bring in strategic security leadership. From missed opportunities and budget misconceptions to the real cost of reactive security, David pulls back the curtain on what's failing quietly inside mid-market orgs and what it actually takes to get security right. Let's get started.
Thank you so much, David, for joining us today. So glad to have you here.
Great to be here.
Most people still associate a CISO with a full-time executive and a big budget enterprise. What's the moment when a company really needs a VCSO, and how do they usually realize it's too late?
So I think a lot of it comes down to being able to transact business and win new business and grow. So I think when customers or prospects start to ask or demand a security program or that their requirements are met and the business struggles to do that, and it becomes kind of the friction point between winning business or retaining customers, I think that's probably the most important and one of the drivers that comes to us for our services. I think some other drivers are things like when management or the board start asking questions and about the security program, it's on their radar as part of their oversight. They need to be doing that. And there's a struggle to articulate the strategy, where the program sound, what is needed. And they just don't get a really solid answer or feeling that that's been being addressed, and they want to bring in somebody who's got the leadership and has done that and is going to give them what they're looking for. I think when compliance regulations get pushed out that actually have teeth and punitive damages and start to become something of concern, and a company is unprepared, they're caught off guard by it, and they're struggling to meet it. And again, back to winning business is another driver. And I think lastly would be an incident or a poor audit or assessment where the company needs an organizational response. Security's kind of lost kind of their standing, or there's confidence issues in the security team, and someone's needed to come in and formulate an action plan that is convincing, it's going to get executed on, and the problems that were found have gone away, and management feels like that's been actioned appropriately.
For companies operating without a formal security leader, what's the hidden cost that creeps in over time? What's breaking behind the scenes before it becomes obvious?
Yeah, usually telltale signs are things like reactive fixes to problems that come up, or requests from outside parties to implement certain security measures that the company was not considering, and they're just sort of reacting to that ask from a prospect or a regulator or something like that. And I think when they put those things in without thought, and they're not thinking about standards, consistency, scalability, training, and follow through for getting those measures to be implemented properly with good thoughtful design and implementation, that's when you start to see, I think, some of the cracks, as you put. I think also when you see companies that have put in point solutions, they might be very, very good point solutions to address a discrete security topic or area, but they're islands and they're on their own and they don't really communicate. They're not integrated. That's, again, there's a big cost to doing that, because at the end of the day, you do need to get a good semblance of what is going on in my environment. And when you have point solutions that don't talk, you've got that blind spot, or you've got to spend a lot of money getting data from systems, aggregate it in one place so you can make heads or tails of it and make decisions about security for the business. And there's definitely a hidden cost to that. And that usually is an indicator of someone who hasn't gone through a build out before, who hasn't learned the lesson of, you know, it's really important that these things are integrated and there's a cohesive tooling strategy to backstop the security program. And you know, you just see those point solutions kind of on their own, doing their own thing. Again, might be great at what they do, but they're not aggregating to help the security function be better.
And then there's the other side, where there are already security leaders in place. How do you tailor your approach as a VCSO when you're walking into a company where the biggest security decision maker is also the head of IT, or maybe the CFO as well?
Yeah. So our at SideChannel, our approach really doesn't change from a starting standpoint. And that is to first, before we do anything else, have strategy and risk discussions with the functional leaders of the business to get a working knowledge of what their business strategy is, what's important to them, what needs to go right for them to be successful as an organization. Before we start testing security, doing gap assessments, anything like that, we definitely need to come out of those sessions with a working knowledge of the strategy and what's a material risk to that business. So as we proceed with the security work and recommending the program build, it's aligned with what matters to them and where the company is headed. What we don't want to be is kind of wayward and kind of off doing a cookie cutter approach to security that just doesn't fit their business. And those sessions, those discussions, Kate, they really help in a couple of different ways. One would be obviously to ensure that alignment. Two, relationship building, right? Relationships and security is paramount, all right? You can't be in the middle of an incident and that's the first time you're meeting the head of legal or the head of compliance or head of finance. You need to have that relationship ahead of time. So building that at the forefront opens up lines of communication. Security is hamstrung if they don't know where the business is headed or what changes are being considered for business activities where security requirements need to be taken care of. So that relationship building is really important. And it also accelerates the institutional knowledge of the VCISO and the team that they're bringing in. Again, there's certain businesses where having institutional knowledge, having an appreciation for their industry, what their customers are looking for, the vernacular of their industry, and maybe even the culture of that business is really important to helping get security measures and a program kind of leveled in there. I would say second, that was a long answer, but the approach doesn't have to really change that much. Security is a business job. I think one of the misconceptions is that it's a tech job. It's really a business job. It's a leadership role. And the job of that VCISO is to translate tech risk to business speak. So, and put it in terms that CFO is going to understand, give them priorities, give them options, and really show that you've got command of what needs to happen, but reality of, what's achievable in the short term and what you recommend they take on to really get results for the business. But at the end of the day, staying in step with that business is how you kind of tackle that.
Yeah. And, a lot of these companies have probably tried a third party before, and in some cases they may have been burned, or they can be kind of skeptical about bringing in outside resources. So when you're the outside voice responsible for the internal security posture, how do you earn that trust fast, especially in those cases where they have been burned?
Yeah. Yeah. I think starting with those sessions, establishing credibility through how you operate, being in purposeful about building those relationships is really important. And I think having your goalposts be making sure that security objectives are accomplished for the business in the best way possible, the most prudent way possible, whether that means going to market for solutions, using incumbent technology that maybe it's not the best, but it's workable, it's in place, and there's bigger fish to fry around security. So let's just work with what we've got. I think demonstrating continually that you're focused on results, focused on achieving security objectives, not selling solutions into them or trying to expand the business, is the most important factor in building up trust and making a client feel really good about who they're hitched up with from a VCISO standpoint. And I would also say, saying no sometimes is really impactful. I think a lot of consultants say you have to do 100 things, right? The checklist says so. And we might come in and say, well, yeah, there's probably 10 things that need to happen. And realistically, we can focus on 2 or 3. And that's what we're going to do. And there's other things that, yeah, maybe in a perfect world, but we don't need to address those. We don't have infinite resources. We can say no to those things and be on solid ground when we defend our decision not to action certain things that maybe popped up on a checklist, but for this particular business just aren't germane, impactful, material, and there's better ways to spend the security investment that's been set aside.
Definitely. I think one of the big things that I've noticed with consulting companies is that they struggle with setting expectations and setting clear ones so that these other businesses know exactly what to expect and what to get, because in their mind, they've hired you for a service. So most things come as a yes to what they expect you to say, but not everything makes realistic sense. So that's definitely a good point. And on the side of misconceptions, what's one of the most common misconceptions you run into about what a VCSO actually does, and how do you dismantle it?
Yeah, I would say more often than not, we run into like no conception. People go, I've heard of VCSO, I'm not really sure what that means. Like, can you help explain it to me? I think that happens more often, which happy to have that conversation. But if I had to pick one, I think it's the misconception that we have a VCSO and that one person can do everything in security that we need. And that's just not realistic. You know, our approach is it's a service. Well, you get assigned a VCSO who will be your point of contact, be responsible for your strategy and your overall program. We have a bench of SMEs that can be brought in to address a particular area, chip in on a specific project to help make sure that it goes properly, and we get the best people onto it. So I think a misconception is that, you know, you'll ring us, you know, Gradient will ring us in the middle of the night when there's a sit rep that needs to be actioned. And, you know, the VCSO is going to be the one waking up at 2 a.m. when it's like, no, or they're going to be patching systems or running tooling and things like that. The VCSO is really, it's a strategy role, right? It's helping clients who struggle to establish a vision for where they need to be for security, logical steps on how to get there, and implement to it. So I think that's kind of one of the misconceptions, is there's one person that can do it all, and it's operational, it's tactical, it's strategic, all in one.
It's one of those things where so many people have learned to wear a million hats. And I think it just becomes, in a lot of roles, that kind of perception of, okay, we've hired someone who it feels like a generalist or someone who can do all the things, but it just doesn't work that way in reality. So you've got deep visibility across industries. Are there any patterns you're seeing in how mid-market companies are failing quietly when it comes to their cyber readiness?
As a rule, I think in the mid-market, it's actually getting better. I think as you have talented leaders who maybe have, you know, done their thing in large enterprises and are finding, you know, they really like working in the small to mid-market, but they've got, they know what needs to happen. They know what great looks like, and they know what to ask for. So I think there's more, you know, management teams that are in tune with security, curious about it, asking better questions. But I think there's still, I see a disconnect between leadership and line level security sometimes, that it's interesting to me because it really doesn't need to be there. It's almost like there's at the line level, there's assumptions being made that budget is fixed. I can't even approach leadership and voice a concern because it is what it is, or they won't understand it. Leadership is assuming that if they're not hearing anything, things must be okay. We're not hearing anything. And I think brokering those conversations is a really important thing to getting better security in place. My experience is the higher up you go in an organization, those are typically people that are insistent on making sure that especially critical areas of the business are protected and well run, and that they know about it, and that budget is set aside for things that really need to, you know, be taken care of. And a lot of times that conversation just isn't happening for whatever reason. Good leaders know that budget is not a good enough reason to not do something that is truly, truly critically important. They'll find the money. But they need to know and be aware of the problem. And maybe part of the issue is the messaging that's coming up. You know, what is the risk exposure? Can I clearly articulate it? Can I explain in simple terms so that leadership team can understand, like, okay, now I get it. I understand the value of my business. It's at risk here. Let's have a conversation about it and figure out how to get what you need.
Yeah, and a lot of companies take either a proactive strategy or a reactive strategy. Walk me through how you think about layering proactive strategy with reactive capability, especially in a lean organization. How do you balance the what if with the what now?
Yeah, when I look at coming into a company and getting that baseline, if and only if they have a quality detection and response capability in place, will I start working from, you know, kind of in NIST terms, left to right, right? Identify and protect, and start thinking about building a program that has a basis in great asset management, complete and accurate, reliable, and then can string other security functions off of that. But if they don't have good detection and response, that's my starting point. We need to stabilize that business. the pace and the sophistication of attacks is too fast to not have that in place. And it's just going to be a disruption to the other security programs that need to be built if you're constantly swatting down incidents that are coming up because good detection and response isn't in place. So that's kind of my starting point. If it isn't in place, it's just going to be an impediment to rolling out the rest of the program. And I think from a balance standpoint, it's not one or the other, protective or detective. It's both companies' end-to-end security. So I think integrating those two functions is what's really important. Establishing clarity of roles so people know precisely what they're responsible for, what they're doing, who they need to communicate to, will get results faster. Having standard procedures that people can just work around and understand, like what can I expect is going to happen in a situation like this, is really important to getting security issues addressed. And then training of individuals and opening up those lines of communication between the protective and detective side is really important. So it really needs to be tightly integrated.
Definitely. So let's say a company has coverage in place, some EDR here, firewall there, a couple of cloud policies. From your point of view, where do most people's setups fall apart when they're tested?
Poor deployment, lack of a complete and accurate asset inventory to make sure that the deployment is sound from the get-go. And then as time goes on, if there's blind spots that emerge, those can usually be the unraveling of a good, what would otherwise be a pretty good security deployment. And that kind of traces back to, all right, do I have a problem with asset management or do I have a problem with change management, right? Things are being introduced to the environment and central visibility and control has no idea that that's happening and to get their tooling on it. So that's usually where it comes down. I think also, where there is a deployment and for some reason it's stopped working effectively and there's no monitoring mechanism to find a hung process on an endpoint where the EDR is not working, for example, is also a problem. I view detection and response as one of the, it's the front lines, the last line, not the front lines, but I guess the last line, and really the friction point where the rubber meets the road for security. And it has to work great all the time. It has to be continually inspected to make sure it's functioning properly. The deployment is got the reach it needs. And that if there is a deviation because, software changes and unwanted things happen or unexpected things can happen, then it's caught timely and it's addressed.
So when you're helping an organization improve their detection and response, how do you prioritize gaps in network, endpoint, SaaS, and cloud? What's your triage lens?
Yeah, this one hits home. I don't understand how a deployment could have intentional blind spots in the network. That just doesn't make sense to me. I have a moral problem with it. That's where, again, having the conversation from an experienced leader who can explain in terms to leadership that, why securing or monitoring 80% of your network and leaving the other 20 to chance is very unwise. You really want all of that security, meaningful security data coming into one central location. Whether you have to put it into an analogy of like a security system for your home, five doors, right? Why put, a monitoring device on one or an alarm on three versus all five? It just doesn't make sense. So you kind of have to make the point of why blind spots are an issue and why a healthy deployment is really where we need to be. And again, fight for that budget to make sure that it's in place properly. The flip side of that, where, again, kind of back to my earlier comment about maybe there's a perception that, well, this is what I have to work with, so I've got to make choices. And I haven't raised the concern to make the business accept the risk or find the money to augment the deployment. The flip side is, there's an incident and it comes back to the root cause was it was on unmonitored systems and leadership says, why wasn't that part of the MDR deployment? Well, our budget only got us to this extent. Why didn't you come to me? Well, we thought this was the budget. Like that, those are kind of the things that they sound silly, but they actually happen a lot.
Yeah, it's hard when a budget's supposed to be a hard line and you realize, oh, we need to figure out how to make this work. You can't always stretch a budget, but It's just a communication thing, right?
We have to have the conversation. Yeah, no, exactly right. You know, the business has to understand what's, you know, what's being done and what's not. I think there's a hesitancy to have that conversation, right? And maybe you've got someone who's, again, at the line level, just sort of doesn't want to make waves or be that squeaky wheel, but I encourage it to happen. And sometimes the VC can kind of come in and broker that conversation and help bridge the knowledge gap there.
Absolutely. So there's a big difference between compliance and security. How do you prevent clients from mistaking checkbox wins for actual resilience?
Yeah, I mean, I encourage our clients to focus on implementing to a framework, NIST, ISO, CIS, pick your poison, and then following through on it. Compliance is usually a subset of a broader framework because it maybe deals with a specific area related to privacy or certain types of data, for example. It's not a comprehensive security program. So implementing to a robust industry vetted framework is wise. By doing so, you bring credence to your program. You're not just winging it, and you can substantiate the decisions that you've made. You can kind of measure how healthy your program is and what's remaining to do. And there aren't questions when people look at your program and your approach to say, like, what is it that you did here? And if it's something that they know is considered a pretty robust framework, you stand a better chance. So they are two different things, right? Good security. I always say, like, compliance is a byproduct of good security, is kind of how it should be. So, you know, implementing to that solid framework end to end that fits your business will take care of a lot of the compliance obligations that you might come up against in your business.
Definitely. So I guess kind of along the same lines, especially when we were talking about budgeting, in your experience, what does just enough security look like for a company that's resource constrained, but they're serious about doing it right?
Yeah, highly relevant topic right now. A lot of belt tightening, a lot of tough decisions being made, and I get it. I always, you know, there's no substitute for getting the fundamentals right. In fact, when I see clients that have implemented sexier things without getting the fundamentals right, it's again kind of an indicator that maybe they need to go back and take a look at that again. I would double down on specific areas that we just find are statistically significant to, you know, experiencing issues, which are, you know, getting great email security in place. That's still the number one avenue for attacks and unwanted outcomes. So great email security, great detection and linked with great detection and response, strong protection around identity. So MFA, a lot of use of tools and automation. There's a lot of, even at the smaller end, right? You still have access to network management systems that have by design things that you can take advantage of without breaking the budget. You don't always have to buy another tool. There's a lot of capabilities within Active Directory, within other IAM systems where you can leverage automation to your benefit because maybe you are resource constrained or staff constrained. And then I think it's really like communication is vital as well. When maybe you can't get all of the things done and you're just focused on sort of the core set of, you know, high, you know, controls over high risk areas, that good communication and revisiting that is important.
Definitely. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that a lot of people struggle with, especially just nowadays, because there's so much out there and there's always the new shiny thing that's sticking out. But a lot of people don't really fully utilize the tools and the resources that they have. And they miss out on some important capabilities and ended up duplicating those efforts by buying the new tool that's shiny because it does one cool thing, but forgetting that the basic tools that they use every day have those capabilities already.
Yeah, maximizing what you're getting out of the tooling. And that is a common theme that we see, right? That a solution is bought to address one area, but it doesn't really, you know, they haven't implemented it fully to address and get all the benefit out of it. And again, I think that's a leadership issue, right? That is someone who is sensitive to budget, who is sensitive to, you know, I've lobbied for this investment from the business. I've stated that it's going to address these areas of concern. I got what I asked for, but if I haven't implemented it properly and there's still issues coming up, that's going to come back on me. And that's really something that an astute leader would be looking into and following through on and making sure that, you know, those investments are getting the most value.
Definitely. And As these companies mature, especially the ones in the higher end of the mid-market, they start to decide whether it's time to scale internally. So how do you decide when it's time to start scaling internal security internally versus continuing to rely on a virtual model like a VCSO and MXDR?
Mm-hmm. I think high-risk business activities, right? Companies are always changing. Maybe they're, you know, implementing new lines of business, new products and services that maybe vault them to, you know, a different level on the risk, you know, tier. Business activities where institutional knowledge on the security team is critical to getting it right, whereas that's always going to be a bit of a struggle using a consultant or, you know, somebody on the outside who's there on a fractional basis. So those are, you know, points in time when a discussion might be relevant to seeing if bringing it internal makes sense. Companies with really active M&A programs where there's a lot of integrations, a lot of things to think through long term, could be helpful as well. Maybe even perception, right? You as time goes on, compliance regs go up, demands of customers increase as well, and there's a perception that, you know, I'm using you as my vendor. You don't have an internal security person full time. It just doesn't seem right to me. Right or wrong, sometimes perception's reality, and that needs to be considered. That being said, we have large businesses, 5-6 billion in nature, where the virtual model works perfectly well. It's really not driven by dollar value. It's really driven by, I think, risk. On the MDR standpoint, though, I think there's less of a cause to have to bring that internally. I think it's a real challenge, and I've seen this firsthand, trying to build a security operations center that has all the tooling, all the trained staff, all of the procedures and processes needed to run an effective detection and response program. To do that internally is a very, very tall order. Point in my career where I did testing of a large global deployment of one of those. I think it was to the tune of like $9 or $10 million investment, and I had to fail it because it was ineffective in catching alerts that we were generating, and we started out stealthy and then got very noisy, and it still wasn't working. And you know, that was a tough day to kind of present that that report to that team when they had spent so much time and money. But MDR is a space where, and people use the term people, process, technology a lot. I think the MDR space and the business that, you know, Gradient is in is a great example of where those three things need to come together in a perfect way to be effective, right? You need trained and talented analysts who know what they're doing. You need managers or supervisors who are looking at those analysts, making sure that there's another level of inspection and quality assurance going on for triaging alerts is happening. You need great solid processes that are standard that the analysts can, you know, just second nature for their job and know how to run and to get consistent outcomes and run down security alerts consistently and reliably. And then you need tooling, whether it's a, you know, SIM or something like that. It all needs to come together and you have to keep it great over time. You can't just set it up and forget it. And that's where I think companies realize keeping it good over time, which is essential, is a really tough thing to do because, as you know, as an analyst, you're that, you know, a year, 2 years on the desk looking at a screen, you start to get that 1,000-yard stare and you have career aspirations. Maybe they're studying for the OCP in their spare time. They want to be a pen tester. They want to be an engineer. They want to do consulting. There's turnover there and there's constant retraining and things. And in my view, an alert is an alert, whether it happens at a credit union or a not-for-profit, it really doesn't matter. There's less reason for institutional knowledge to be truly impactful in MDR than it is in other areas, vendor management or something like that, or application design. So I think there's really a strong case to be made for letting company, whose core competency is detection and response, kind of provide that to a customer.
Definitely. And you mentioned it's not a set and forget. It's not one of those, okay, we've done it. It's not like you get your SOC 2 compliance and you're like, yep, we're good forever. Never have to worry about that again, especially those. So what are some of the biggest warning signs that a company's security program is just window dressing, and how do you help them see it?
Yeah, I love this question. A lot of points here, but I would call out a few. Activity, or focus on activity and not results, is something that when we go in, and a lot of times we start with an assessment and people hold up, hey, here's what I do. And it's like, great, but show me the results. Like, what is it actually doing to improve security, or, get those outcomes? Lack of standards and consistency. I call them snowflakes, right? People, whether they're in reactive mode or they just don't have the discipline and the experience of why standards and consistency matter in security, that there's a real cost to doing things differently and uniquely across the business. And there's a risk to it falling down because there's a lack of predictability and standards that you can implement tooling around, because you have, 10 different ways of doing things. Those are telltale signs. I also think when the hard work hasn't been done, right? And we talked about tooling without having sound asset management, platform hardening, good focus on identity and access management. Those are hygiene things that are, people want to get to the tooling and scans and things like that. But the hard work has to be put in, because everything else really keys off of it. Repeat findings, like we do a lot of assessments. We have clients that have pen test programs, and when you see an issue come up over and over again, that's a problem, and it's either a management issue or it's a resource issue. It's one or the other, and that's kind of a tough conversation to have. But that can be one of those things when you start to look under the covers and go, well, did you? Why is this coming back again? Did you fix the symptom, not the actual root cause of the problem? And that sort of thing. And then again, we mentioned tooling, right? Investments in tooling, the inventory, right? When you take the inventory, it looks great. All the good names are there, but are we getting the results out of them? Is the value being coming out of it? Is there a great process wrapped around all these good tools? Is there great reporting? Is there visibility, actionable intelligence coming out of them? Those are kind of telltale signs of where, maybe it's window dressing and not really good foundational security measures.
Definitely. It's like you do the pen test hoping that it comes back well and that all of the results are like you're doing the right things, and sometimes you get it back and you're like, oh god, this is a laundry list and there's so much now that I have to do. And sometimes that stuff is like, oh well, we'll do it later and we'll get to it, and next thing you know, you're at your next pen test and the same thing's still there.
Yeah, and especially for clients that are coming to us where security is run by operational folks, like in IT, right? A lot of times security incubates in IT, and that's a good thing. That's just standard and very natural. But when you're in an operational role, sysadmin, backups, break fix, roll out to support the business, all of those things that need to happen in IT, security is going to take kind of a back seat. Security initiatives, right? You have best intentions, but when something needs to go, you're going to park that. And pen test findings could be one of those items. And that's, again, where brokering that conversation, laying it in front of the right people transparently to go, this is what we're up against. Where does it rank in the order of things that we need to do? Maybe it's not at the top, but it needs to be present and considered.
Yeah. And so you've seen a lot of this incident response play out from the front lines. What's a lesson that you've learned the hard way that you now make sure clients understand early?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty well known that a lot of times in IR, companies think it's a tech problem. It's IT's problem. It's not a business problem. I think that's becoming less and less as people are subject to tabletops and folks like me go in and kind of explain why that's not the case. And I also think one of the things I've learned is, the team makeup is really, really vital in incident response. Having the most technical people on the team isn't necessarily the most important thing. There are skill sets needed in incident response that every company has. There's always go-to people that are critical thinkers, have great networks and can get access to information across the company, have incredible institutional knowledge that can help make better decisions during an incident, because they understand what the business impact could be, what the impact on compliance or contractual obligations might be. They just know everything. Those are great people to have. Folks who are able to move ahead in a situation that might be ambiguous, right? It's rare that you get to certainty in an incident and then you can take action. Sometimes it just takes too long, right? There's a real problem that needs to be addressed, and you have to do the best you can to triage it, understand it, but then move forward. So moving forward in conditions of uncertainty is something that cuts against a lot of people and how they operate, and that's okay. But there's folks that can move ahead, you know, with that. So definitely really action oriented. And then I think people who are disciplined and know that communication is really paramount in those situations, and respecting that whatever communication plan has been implemented and constructed for such a situation should be respected, right? You can't have 11 people pinging their staff for updates on the side and detracting them from getting the response done. There's a real cost to doing that. You know, so I think, you know, folks that are, you know, have invested time, know the role, respect the, you know, the process, and are willing to operate within it and be trained on it periodically, are folks you kind of want on that team.
Definitely. So thank you, David, for joining us today. If anybody wants to learn more about you or Side Channel, how can they reach you?
Yeah, visit our website, sidechannel.com. There's ways to interact with us via our web form. You can book meetings directly with me or some of our staff. We're really active on LinkedIn as well on our Side Channel corporate page.
Awesome. Thank you. This has been great. I think that the one I've learned a ton about VCSOs that I didn't know before, and hopefully our listeners also have learned a lot as well.
That's great. Thanks, Katie.
That's a wrap on this episode of Beyond the Signal. Big thanks to David Minicello and the team at Side Channel for the real talk and hard-won lessons. If this conversation makes you rethink your own security posture or raise some red flags, you're not alone. Subscribe, share, and check out GradientCyber.com to learn how we help businesses like yours stop threats early, close gaps fast, and build security programs that last. Until next time, stay sharp, stay secure, and don't wait for the breach to start asking the right questions.